Okay, we've got the recording set to the cloud. The interpreters are set up. And Veronica, I don't see that you're recording on your own.
No, she's not going to. I'm going to take it and make a video out of both of them myself.
Okay, great. And we still have a couple of people joining from the waiting room. One more. He must have stepped away. It's Scott that's still.
I just let him in.
I tried to let him in. He's still joining. So.
Oh.
Okay. Thank you, Nadell, for letting us know you can't read today. I got it. All right. I think everybody's here. So go ahead, please, Francis. I've got the re recording to the
Okay.
cloud.
Will do. Hello, friends. Welcome to the second webinar on the Light of the Soul, the only blue book that DK actually co-authored with Alice Bailey. In this book, DK dictated an esoteric paraphrasing of the original sutras of Patanjali. AAB then wrote her commentary, and then finally, DK reviewed and adjusted Bailey's commentary to make sure it aligned with the intended esoteric meaning. For those of you new to my webinar series, the panel on the left here is the table of contents with where we presently are, shown in dark blue, and on the right is a photo of the actual page from Light of the Soul, from which we are reading. And then in the middle is that same text in a more readable size and font. And it's this that you'll read from when, if you choose to read. VL, who co-hosts this series, and a big thanks to Mikhail for helping to set up the translators. We've got this series translated in both Greek and Vietnamese. BL will periodically call on people to read. If you'd rather not read, just let us know in the chat, but don't be shy. It's nice to have a bunch of different readers. And I think we can start. We began this series by taking a look at the old commentary that you see here, which is at the very beginning of the book, and which describes the states of consciousness that we must strive for before we can become soul identified. After suggesting that we must become divinely indifferent to the sounds and sights on the physical plane, we come to the third paragraph of the old commentary, which states, before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be united, just as the form to which the clay is modeled is first united with the potter's mind. So the she in she must to the silent speaker be united is the disciple, and the silent speaker is the soul. Union comes by building the antahkarana. The analogy, just as the form to which the clay is modeled is first united with the potter's mind, it's a very subtle analogy. Here, the clay represents the upward striving, imprisoned human soul, which only realizes its true purpose when it becomes aligned with the ideal form held within the potter's mind. The potter is the soul, and the potter's mind is the causal body, informed by the soul's divine intuition. By means of the potter's wheel, the cyclic experience. Somebody's muted. It should be muted.
Yeah. Sorry, let me, I can't see. Oh, well, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Let's drop back to the potter's wheel. So the potter is the soul. The potter's mind is the causal body, informed by the soul's divine intuition. By means of the potter's wheel, the cyclic experience of reincarnation and the discipline of yoga, the soul gradually reforms the lower vehicles into its own image until, finally, the personality becomes a perfectly transparent medium for the light of the soul. So, quite a stunning old commentary from Voice of the Silence by HBB. Okay, we then began AAB's introductory remarks, where we learned that Raja Yoga is called the Royal Path because it is soul-based, as well as the most comprehensive form of yoga, governing the mind and leading to union with spirit. Patanjali is revered as the father of yoga because he transformed the diverse oral traditions of his time into a systematic science that is still being used by people all over the world. Raja Yoga will find its greatest demonstration in the West because, as DK tells us, the West is the locus of the fifth root race, whose purpose is mastery of the mind.
Francis, I lost your voice. Francis, I don't hear you. Can anybody else hear Francis, or is it just me?
No, I don't hear him in Sweden.
No.
No.
Francis, we lost you.
It could be internet. No.
Well, we haven't. He says he'll go out and come back in. He says he'll go out and come back in.
No.
Not yet. I don't see him yet.
He's in, but his mic's open and I don't hear him.
I don't even see him.
Yeah, he's in. His mic's open, so he's trying to talk. Yeah, he's talking into one of the subplanes. They'd rather see his presentation.
Well, there we go. Okay. It won't let me make him a co-host.
Francis, are you able to check your sound settings to make sure that you're...
I don't see his video yet.
Right.
And it That's won't true. Allow me to make him a... It won't
yeah,
allow me to make him a...
Usually your camera would show up if it's available to Zoom, but it's not showing up. There it is.
All right. Yeah, are you hearing me?
Yes.
Awesome.
It won't. It won't let me make you a co-host.
Well, I knew this day would come someday. I can't even be a co-host. There.
What?
I just clicked. Nope. It still won't allow me to turn on my video.
Is it saying can't turn video
it
on?
It says you cannot start your video because it is disabled by the host.
Because you're a guest, not a
guest, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, folks, don't take off. We're going to get this fixed in a minute.
Well, I enabled it so you could turn it on now, but now everybody can turn on their video.
Yeah.
Well, I just came on. Well,
I want Michael. Can you make him a co-host?
I'm not a host. You have to do
I
it
know.
With your host account.
BL2. I'm trying.
Are you doing it with BL2 or BL1?
I'm doing it. Oh, you made BL2.
Yeah, that's what I said.
That's it.
Do you want BL2?
Oh.
Good catch, Mikhail. That's it. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. This happens. Not often, though, fortunately.
Technical difficulty. Dumb.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I'd say blonde, but really it's white.
Okay, let's see here. Share on screen. We get back up. Everybody see that?
Yes, I can.
Yes,
okay,
and
good.
We can hear you. Yay!
Oh, my. All right. So I was talking about Patanjali, father of yoga. He was, you know, however, I mean, his some people put him at after the time of Christ, some 800 years before Christ. Esoterically, he's way back, like thousands of years before, and he gathered all the bits of information that were being used at the time, and he translated them into a systematic science, and it's been used ever since. Okay. Next we learned that Raja Yoga is not a mystical approach, but rather a step-by-step series of techniques for energy transmission from soul to brain, the throughput. And all the steps, all the intermediate steps are covered in the Yoga Sutras, which results in the ability to perceive through illumination knowledge relevant to this realm of the soul. We then took a look at a list that reveals the numerical resonance of the number five. The energy of fiveness is the power of the creative mind to initiate form building, concretion, and thus to embody ideas. AAB then introduces the yogas associated with each root race, Hatha Yoga with Lemuria, Laya and Bhakti Yoga with Atlantis, Jnana and Raja Yoga with the fifth and current Aryan fifth root race. By the way, whenever I put up a chart like this, it doesn't necessarily mean that we'll read through it. You can later go back and take a look at the recording. Even take screenshots if you want to study it more thoroughly. Next, we learned that the third initiation was the highest available during the Lemurian times, and that the fourth initiation was the highest available during Atlantean times. But we have to keep in mind that the difference in the nature of the third initiation in Lemuria compared to the third initiation in modern times is huge. For example, in Lemurian times, because the mental and even the emotional vehicles were dormant, the third or transfiguration initiation was fundamentally different than it is today. It's not a fusion of soul and personality, but rather a profound physical etheric integration, which allowed the light of the etheric body to fully irradiate the dense physical form, producing mastery of the life force or prana by these ancient initiates. We can't really even conceive of the states of consciousness of these early root race initiations. Agatiyan Sakarian. In Atlantis, the third initiation was oriented towards mastery of the astral plane, resulting in a state of emotional serenity or stillness, whereas the fourth initiation was a complete renunciation of the physical astral link, including transcendence of the power of kama or desire, which we're still working on. Most of humanity, except in fact, only a handful really are working with this, overcoming this force of kama, which is the process that we use to take the second initiation. The Atlantean fourth initiation did not include the shattering of the causal body as it now does, but rather the shattering of the link with astral desire consciousness. Okay. Yes, Ariane.
Oh, just a few comments. Is there space for that here?
Yes.
Okay. Just one is that Maitreya was a third degree initiate in the Lemurian times. So it gives us a sense of scale, how early and how amazing he was that he came from our earth and so long ago was able to reach the highest level of initiation then, which was the third degree. The second thing is this chart, which I beg to differ a little bit about Jnana Yoga, because did you get this from Alice Bailey's writings or where did this come from?
I formulated the chart myself based on Bailey, based on Bailey's teachings, not based on traditional Indian teachings, but the Bailey perspective.
And did DK link it with lower mind anywhere? Because it is about the mind, but it's also about going beyond even the witness. So to the place where all is, so that both the observed and the observer is basically obliterated beyond the soul. So it is an intellectual method through Adyas Shankaracharya, who was an avatar, who brought that. He was like a wandering teacher, using like the Socratic method at the time. And it uses reason, but it really, if it seems to go beyond the mind as I understand it. And then if I can find it, I just wanted to mention in relationship to what you said about the number of initiates. Maybe I'll put it in the chat if I can't find it.
Yeah, I want to address what you just said. I believe you actually practice Jnana Yoga. Is that correct?
Practice is a big deal.
You're yeah. aware of it. You're yeah.
I'm
okay.
Studying
there's
it. Yeah. I'm studying it. So,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. This chart is conditioned by the fact of its relationship to the races. So Jnana Yoga would have been an initial phase of the Aryan race in order to develop lower mind. It doesn't surprise me at all that current practitioners of Jnana Yoga would be working beyond that, since lower mind is now a well-developed vehicle among humanity. So that's something that has to be taken into account here, that these yogas were the means by which the race was developed. And so earlier, it doesn't say here early Aryan root race, but it was where this was introduced to develop the initial phases, initial stages of mental development.
Yeah, I
So,
really appreciate that correction. And then if I could just read this paragraph, it says that about, in the mid 1980s, there were only 850,000 people in incarnation who had taken the first initiation, which means 1.2 million about now. And then at that time, there were only 240,000 people in incarnation who had taken the second initiation, and about 2,300 to 2,400 who had taken the third initiation, and only 450 in the mid 80s who had taken the fourth initiation. This is according to Benjamin Krem's master, the Master of Wisdom, whom he worked with. And so when we think about Maitreya taking the third initiation in Lemurian times, it's absolutely
singular.
mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's singular. He was at the cutting edge, was the first to get to the sixth initiation. Now, of those who began their human career on this globe, there were those like the Buddha who started on the moon chain, and this whole thing that I read about the nature of the initiations in Lemurian and Atlantean times wouldn't apply to those who developed on the moon chain, because they wouldn't have been restricted by the races that they were incarnating into in order to be a teacher of men in those distant times. So, yes, Tia.
I think some of the confusion or discrepancy arises from the fact that in your chart, you're describing these particular yogas as a process, as a way of becoming. And then in light of the soul, which I put in the chat about Jnana Yoga, and what I think Ariana is talking about is a state of being. So there's a distinction there between the two.
And it's also, as it is currently practiced compared to a historical process. So yes, yeah, it's a good distinction. Okay. All right, finally, DK tells us that, quote, now in the Aryan race, the subjugation of the mental body and the control of the mind is brought about through the practice of Raja Yoga and the fifth initiation, that of adept. Interesting, that's usually associated with the fourth, is the goal for evolving humanity. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. So let's start this session up with this next passage. Could we get a reader, please?
I'll start it off. It will be found that through the practice of Raja Yoga and through assuming that point of directional control, which is to be found by the man who centers his consciousness in the soul, the other forms of yoga are unnecessary, for the greater yoga automatically includes all the lesser in its results, though not in its practices. When these are studied, it will become apparent why the day of opportunity has only just arrived. The East has preserved rules for us since time immemorial. Here and there, Orientals, with a few Western adepts, have availed themselves of those rules and have submitted to the discipline of this exacting science. Thus has been preserved for the race the continuity of the secret doctrine with the ageless wisdom, and thus has been gathered together personnel of the hierarchy of our planet. In the time of the Buddha, and through uh-oh, hold on, here we go. And through the stimulation he produced, there was a great gathering in of arhats. These were men who achieved liberation through self-initiated effort. This period in our Aryan race marked a climax for the East.
Thank you, BL. Okay, first, it will be found that through the practice of Raja Yoga and through assuming that point of directional control, which is to be found by the man who centers his consciousness in the soul, the other forms of yoga are unnecessary, for the greater yoga automatically includes all the lesser in its results, though not in its practices. That last phrase is important. So key here is the phrase directional yoga, which suggests that the direction of energy flow is the critical point. Raja yoga, where the higher principle dictates the behavior of the lower, reverses the flow used in some of the previous yoga practices like Hatha yoga, which work from below upwards. As to the greater yoga automatically includes all the lessers in its results, Raja Yoga centers on controlling the mind and bridging it to the soul, resulting in the spontaneous and automatic subjugation of the physical and emotional vehicles. The results of Hatha, Bhakti, and Jnana Yoga are still necessary, but the specific practices used to achieve these results are no longer required. That said, at least in my opinion, using the asanas of Hatha Yoga to stretch and tone the muscles of your body is perfectly fine. I would just avoid any breathing exercises unless following the guidance of a master, for example, DK in his series of meditations in Discipleship in the New Age, Volumes 1 and 2. By the way, I welcome questions and comments. Anytime you have anything that's unclear to you, please raise your hand and ask, because what you'll find is that there's 20 other people that it's also unclear to. So feel free, don't be shy.
Francis?
Yeah.
Okay, first off, Ariane put that information that she gave us in the chat, and so did Tia, as she mentioned to us. And then Diana asks, is Agni Yoga the spiritual yoga of the next root race?
Agni Yoga, that came through Yoga, Yogananda, it's the yoga of fire. And it looks like Tia might be better at answering this than I am.
I think DK does say it is the yoga of the sixth root, right?
Doesn't he really? Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead,
I
Tia.
Defer to that. Tia, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you take this all from sort of a high level view, and I'm thinking about Blavatsky, I was in another class, and they credited her with really trying to bring the one truth that subsumes all religions to the forefront so that everyone could understand it.
Right.
And to that point, and these yogas, it really is, if you take it from a high level view, the evolution of humanity's consciousness through working through the body, the physical, etheric, then the astral, and then the mental. And the one truth that subsumes all of these and is the one remaining idea, even in Hatha Yoga, he starts off with this, is that they talk about the silent speaker being the soul. So all these religions want in some way to give voice to this concept of soul so that we can understand it. Even if you look at something like the Tao Te Ching, it's alignment with the soul, if you look at it. The whole philosophy is based on that in Anima Mundi. If the silent speaker is the soul, the silent watcher is the monad. And so as we evolve into this yoga of fire, we have established that alignment with the soul. And then we go into the great, go into the triad. And these basic yogas, they track the evolution of man's consciousness. And so if you go into Raja Yoga, hopefully you will have put that point where you've actually gone into the monastic principle. establish contact with the soul on the second subplane, and then you can be ready to go into the Agni Yoga, which will help you enter into the spiritual triad.
Well, yeah, well said. It's the relevant yoga for the time is always what comes to the fore. But the animating source of whatever yoga was always monadic and by way of the soul. It's just that it's now no longer necessary since the original Hatha Yoga, not the Hatha Yoga of today, but the original Hatha Yoga, the purpose was to destroy the cleavage between the physical and the etheric bodies, to heal that cleavage. And that is now everyone on the planet. That cleavage is now healed. There's no one that incarnates where they are still separate. So you really do have to look at the purpose of the yoga at the time. Thank you for your comments there. Ariane.
So I really appreciate that you've moved on to Agni Yoga because we know that the soul is not the highest potential for us. We want to be at a higher place, the modan, it's the monad. And so when he's talking about Raja Yoga, he's talking to the people of the time. And when you think about Agni Yoga, if you've read any of the Helena Rourke books, in which she, instead of, she actually articulated the words of Moria and also Maitreya, the first two books, Leaves of Moria's Garden, the first two volumes, those were by Maitreya himself, and the other ones were by Moria. And they have a totally different quality than DK. As extraordinary as every sentence is in any of Alice Bailey's books, as the layered quality, the denseness, the depth, the conciseness of DK's writing is, there's a different kind of knowingness that is in the Agni Yoga series. It's pure poetry. It's coming from like the higher mind and the higher emotional center. So it's done in imagery. And then for someone who spent years, attending like Agni Yoga ceremonies, these are like the fire ceremonies in places where I lived when I was younger. So it's all about the destruction of the unreal, the Shiva force, the first ray. It's a totally different, fierce orientation to spirituality that we just cannot bear or even imagine now. I don't think it's, I think it's not that she's saying that Raja Yoga is the highest. She's saying this is the yoga of the time of DK.
Yeah, it's second ray soul-based yoga, which is applicable to all but a handful of people. And that handful would have no need to read any of these books because they would have direct contact with the teacher. So appreciate your comments. Thank you. Okay, next. When these are studied, it will become apparent why the day of opportunity has only just arrived. The East has preserved rules for us since time immemorial. Here and there, Orientals, with a few Western adepts, have availed themselves of those rules and have submitted to the discipline of this exacting science. Okay, so when these are studied, are the earlier forms of yoga. The quote unquote day of opportunity has arrived because the Aryan race has finally developed the mental vehicle required to understand and apply those ancient rules of control that the East has guarded for centuries. We're no longer infant humanity needing physical discipline, but have become mental beings where Raja Yoga, the kingly science of the soul, will optimize our opportunity for growth. Did you have your hand up, Tia? Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to make an observation about what's going on right now, because I think that the interesting thing is with the incoming seventh ray, we are sometimes people forget that it's a subray of the third ray. And at the point right now, we have a preoccupation with form. But the distinction between the seventh ray and the third ray is the whole concept of the father principle or fire. Descending into form and inhabiting it. And when we talked earlier, and when she introduced these different sorts of yogas and how they evolve, it's the unfoldment of the various siddhis that one experiences as one progresses through these various yogas. And I think you stopped at the concept of the intuition being unfolded, which we will need so much now because we have to be able to distinguish between mere form and then also the father principle inhabiting form. And to the untrained mind, they may appear to be the same thing. And so I don't think we're past Vajra Yoga at all. We're really at a point now where we're going to have to apply it and utilize it. And then once we have grounded ourselves in that, and we can reach the voice of the silence where there is no seedy necessary because there's no discriminative mind. You are in a state of being. It's pure fire.
Right, and a part of this is the right use of form. Form won't be discarded until even that discussion won't be happening until the seventh root race, and then more thoroughly, the seventh globe, the seventh round, the seventh chain, where spirit triumphs. But in the meantime, the job of the white magician is right use of form, in service to humanity, and the decentralization that that takes, for that right use to come about, is one of the main themes of this book. How to properly use the form aspect. Tia?
Yeah, this is a little bit, it's not off topic, but it is sort of a support for your whole series on Treatise on Cosmic Fire, because with the planetary alignments and also in the Chinese astrological chart that deals basically with energy, this whole concept of fire and Agni Yoga and these different yoga practices, energy is going to be moving very quickly. And so we have to ground ourselves in these practices. And what we're finding as we move from a sixth ray age to the seventh ray age, those people who have not grounded themselves in these practices are being will be flung far and wide by this fast-moving energy that we're finding ourselves enmeshed in. And the normal human personality response is to seek the past, where things were much more slower and controlled. And so that's another way that the sixth and seventh ray struggle is playing out. So all of these things, I guess my whole point in having this discussion is that these are not merely words on paper, but things to be applied in everyday life.
Right, we're seeing these energies play out in our daily lives. And I would add to what you said, about the resistance, and the retrenchment that's going on with six ray types, is that eventually there will be less and less opportunity for those who have that orientation to incarnate, and they will hold position until an appropriate time to come back in. So, thank you, Tia. Okay, next up. Thus has been preserved for the race the continuity of the sacred doctrine of the ageless wisdom, and thus has been gathered together the personnel of the hierarchy of our planet. This suggests that the Hierarchy is itself the aggregate of those beings who have successfully applied the rules of Raja Yoga in their own lives. By doing so, they have not only achieved individual liberation, but have also served as the living vehicles that, quote, preserved for the race the continuity of the ageless wisdom across the ages. Okay, and finally, in the time of the Buddha and through the stimulation he produced, there was a great gathering in of arhats. These were men who had achieved liberation through self-initiated effort. This period in our Aryan race marked a climax for the East. So, for thousands of years, the spiritual goal championed by Eastern traditions was for the individual to achieve the state of the arhat, a fourth initiate, and thus liberate themselves from the wheel of rebirth. The Buddha's life was the ultimate demonstration of this. He proved that a human being could, through sheer intellectual and spiritual discipline, jnana and raja yoga, break the veils of illusion. This represented the high watermark of Eastern spiritual achievement, according to AAB in this passage, brought about by the specific stimulation produced by this great being incarnating the Buddha. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Pia, can you read that for us, please?
Since then, the tide of spiritual life has steadily flowed westward, and we may now look for a corresponding climax in the West, which will reach its zenith between the years 1965 and 2025. Towards this end, the adepts of the East and of the West are unitedly working where they follow always the law. This coming impulse is, as was that in the time of the Buddha, a second-rate impulse and has no relation to any first-rate impulse, such as that which brought forth H.P. Blavatsky. First-rate impulses rise in the first quarter of each century and reach their climax on the physical plane during the last quarter. The interest now shown in Raja Yoga and the study of this science and the rules it provides for man's unfoldment is indicative of the general trend of the rising second-rate impulse. This interest will be increasingly shown. Thus comes the day of opportunity.
Thank you, Tia. So first, since then, we're talking about the time of the Buddha, the tide of spiritual life has steadily flowed westward, and we may now look for a corresponding climax in the West, which will reach its zenith between the years 1965 and 2025. Towards this end, the adepts of the East and of the West are unitedly working, for they follow always the law. Okay, so since the time of the Buddha, the tide of spiritual life, the quote-unquote tide, being an energetic shift from the wisdom aspect of the second ray to the love aspect of that ray, has shifted westwards, mirrored, we might assume, by the shifted primacy of the Buddha to that of the Christ, and that a similar peak influx of the life aspect was reached, you can only just now say was reached, between 1965 and 2025, suggesting that a group of high initiates has also emerged during this period. The statement towards this end, the adepts of the East and of the West are unitedly working, undoubtedly references the hierarchy, which contained masters and adepts from both East and West, as well as the new group of world servers who link the hierarchy to humanity. The law, in For They Always Follow the Law, is the law of cycles, which governs the quote economy of the races. We can only assume that the 2025 conclave had something to do with marking the end of this cycle and initiating the next. Next. This coming impulse, as was that in the time of the Buddha, a second ray impulse, and has no relation to any first ray impulse, such as that which brought forth H.P. Blavatsky. So the spiritual opportunity of the 1965 to 2025 period brought to the fore all the qualities of the second ray with an emphasis on the love aspect, just as there was an emphasis on the wisdom aspect during the time of the Buddha. AAB then goes on to contrast HPB's first ray soul method of presenting the ageless wisdom, which was necessary in order to break through the inertia of her time and the extraordinary resistance, with DK's second ray method. Now, when she says, you know, this second ray method has nothing to do with the first ray method of Blavatsky, that doesn't mean that the theosophy of Bailey has nothing to do with the theosophy of Blavatsky. You know, DK actually dedicates a treatise on cosmic fire to Blavatsky, and they're deeply interwoven. There are often detailed footnotes that bring forth the teachings from the secret doctrine in order to inform the material in the Bailey books. So it's not about a different theosophy. It's about the fundamental difference between these two ray types and the approach that those who are championing or working with these ray types use. Okay. Next, first ray impulses rise in the first quarter of each century and reach their climax on the physical plane during the last quarter. Okay, so the first ray impulse is used to initiate a new cycle. The destroyer aspect of the first ray is used to clear away the old thought forms of the dying cycle so that new truths can take hold. Interestingly, the Theosophical Society was founded in 1875, exactly at the beginning of the last quarter of the 19th century, and the movement reached its high water mark during the first quarter of the 20th century under Annie Besant. There's a number of ways to look at this. And finally, the interest now shown in Raja Yoga and the study of the sciences and the rules it provides for man's unfoldment is indicative of the general trend of this rising second ray impulse. This interest will be increasingly shown. Thus comes the day of opportunity. So the mental science of the soul, as presented through Raja Yoga, is the destined method for spiritual progress during the quote-unquote day of opportunity, which AAB identifies as the period between 1965 and 2025, and that this is in keeping with the rise of the influence of the second ray. Okay, any thoughts or questions about anything covered so far? All right, then.
Tia just says, adding to what you were saying a minute ago, that they each use a different key to unlock the ancient wisdom, meaning the secret doctrine and DCF.
Yeah. You know, they're incredibly different and at the same time have extraordinarily interconnected, you could call it like a matrix of purpose, and that matrix, the HPB version was the appropriate matrix of the times, starting in 1875, because you have to remember that it all was brand new, except for those who were deeply involved in the esoteric sections of, the different spiritual disciplines. But, for the general public, this was brand new stuff. And so when Isis Unveiled came out in 1875, nothing like it. Nothing like it really had been written. And then the Secret Doctrine really further unveiled that. DK built very specifically built on HPB's work, but using a different ray approach, one that was more appropriate for preparation for the coming age. Tia?
I would say I agree with you, but also when I look at Alice Bailey's work, I think about it in terms of being a psychological key. And within the framework of H.P. Blee's work, which really to me goes back and forth between third ray and first ray, is the structure, the underlying structure for this the second ray approach, the psychological approach, which is a study of the soul. And if you think about it, the astrology that HPB uses and the astrology that Master DK introduced very much is the mo has ushered in the modern age of astrology, which was lost. And he looks at it from a soul's perspective, but from you're not looking at astrology from the point of traditional astrology, which looks at a person and their relationship to outer circumstances and people, but rather the internal mind and how that person is functioning internally as a soul. So we're going between God transcendent and God immanent. And I think for purposes of study, HPB had to start at God transcendent and give us all of that cosmic history and everything to provide a framework so that Master DK could come in and do a very precise analysis of her work and pull out the psychological key, which now has given birth to Jungian astrology, Adlerian astrology, B.F. Skinner astrology. He brought in the modern age of esotericism.
Yeah, that's well said. The specific qualities of the new psychology were, even though they were hinted at in HPB, they were vastly expanded on by DK. Such studies as astrology and the rays are, way, way more developed by DK. I find that HPB's one of HPB's main gifts to the ageless wisdom is her reference to existing forms. She would describe the ancient Japanese tradition and how they relate and exemplify the ageless wisdom, and then the Egyptian forms, and give you literally a blow by blow relationship between the three aspects of Brahma, the creator, and that they were actually gods in ancient Egypt, and bring in those teachings that exist for anybody who can read it in the Egyptian Book of the Dead and other sources. DK doesn't do that at all. I mean, very, very little. Occasional reference to the Bible and some other forms, but that was really HPB's strong suit. And you can see how, for introducing the ageless wisdom again, in the form of theosophy, that that's the perfect way to do it. That you cite the those disciplines that have come before that already have this in their expression, You know, theosophy is adamant about saying that it's teaching nothing new, though there's new areas that it's introducing for the first time. The concepts have been with us as long as this root race and longer, you know. So anyway, just more comments on the contrasting them. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. There are three books which should be in the hands of every student: the Bhagavad Gita, the New Testament, and the Yoga Sutras. For in these three is contained a complete picture of the soul and its unfoldment. In the Gita, we have given us, in its 18 chapters, a description of the soul, of Krishna, the second aspect, in his true nature as God in manifestation, culminated in that marvelous chapter where he reveals himself to Arjuna, the aspirant, as the soul of all things and the point of glory behind the veil of every form. In the New Testament, there is depicted for us the life of a son of God in full manifestation, wherein, freed from every veil, the soul in its true nature walks the earth. It becomes apparent to us, as we study the life of Christ, what it means to develop the powers of the soul, to attain liberation and become in full glory a God walking on earth.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, first, there are three books which should be in the hands of every student: the Bhagavad Gita, the New Testament, and the Yoga Sutras. For in these three is contained a complete picture of the soul and its unfoldment. So AAB considers these three books essential because the Bhagavad Gita gives us a description of the soul, the New Testament an example of the soul in incarnation, and the Yoga Sutras a method for achieving soul infusion. There's going to be so much said about these later. That's all that needs to be said here. Next, in the Gita, we have given us, in its 18 chapters, a description of the soul of Krishna, the second aspect, in his true nature as God in manifestation, culminating in that marvelous chapter where he reveals himself to Arjuna, the aspirant, as the soul of all things and the point of glory behind the veil of every form. So the Gita gives us both a vision and a definition of the goal of humanity. The marvelous chapter is almost certainly chapter 11, where Krishna reveals himself as the soul of all things, thereby confirming that every form, whether an atom, a man, or planet, is essentially a vehicle for the soul aspect. The veil of every form refers to the illusion or maya of the material world, and the point of glory is God immanent, or the jewel in the lotus, hidden within the heart of every being. The purpose of this revelation is to enable Arjuna to see past outer appearances so that he might contact the subjective reality which animates these appearances. Any thoughts or questions about this?
Ariane says that it's an interesting retelling of the conflict between the soul and personality, as a recreation of the Gita is the breathtaking film, The Life of Pi.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Okay. Later in the text, Alice Bailey reveals that the battlefield of Kurukshetra, where Arjuna finds himself, symbolizes the astral plane. Arjuna is depicted as standing midway between the two opposing forces of good and evil. This midway point represents the state of the disciple who is torn between the pull of the lower nature and the soul. His hesitation to engage in battle illustrates the difficulty of making the quote-unquote great choice. I can't help but think that this also represents the Libran choice of whether or not to reverse oneself on the wheel of life. Finally, in the New Testament, there is depicted for us the life of a Son of God in full manifestation, wherein, freed from every veil, the soul in its true nature walks the earth. It becomes apparent to us as we study the life of Christ what it means to develop the powers of the soul, to attain liberation and become in full glory a God walking on earth. So we move from a definition of the soul given in the Gita to a demonstration of the soul, the life of a Son of God in full manifestation in the New Testament. In terms of the sutras, the veils refer to the modifications of the mind, the so-called kleshas, or hindrances and afflictions, and the gunas, qualities of matter that hide the light of the soul, which, when removed, allow the personality to become a perfect transmitter of that soul light. Yes, Ariane.
I can't resist. So just that, when you look at that painting or those paintings and you see the, you know, the battlefields arrayed on both sides, the aim is like with Advaita Vedanta, which is Jnana Yoga, is this to go beyond duality and to see everything as a projection from within oneself. So all these soldiers are desires, thoughts, mechanical reactions, stimuli. And it's all happening within oneself. And in Jnana Yoga, one comes to see the, just like when they show Vishnu or Shiva, just imagining the world like lying on a lotus, just experiencing only consciousness with all these, you know, actors and props and dramas. And then with the crucifixion, I mean, these are my, I just, these stories, which are both dramas, dramatic plays, and also historical events. So the fourth, the crucifixion, which is a play about the fourth initiation or the grand renunciation, what you see is similarly to this painting. You see someone who's actually taken on dharma or the personal law of karma and also group's karma. So the karma of his family, his nation, the human species, and showing what is the right relationship. So when Jesus carries the cross, that's like the easy symbol of it, because everyone knows, you know, from their own feeling state, oh, I know what it means to have a burden that's too heavy to carry, or I know what it means to be unjustly victimized. But then he goes beyond that and shows this is the karma that we've all earned, and I carry it without protest, without defense. I totally embrace it. I accept it. It's radical acceptance, as some people use that word. And there's no buffering. It's just the willingness to see things as they are, but also the strength, the spiritual stature to be able to do that. And so I see that there, these two stories, in some sense, the Gita is much more practical because it's like a cookbook. It gives precise instructions through its stories about how to awaken, whereas the crucifixion is more about what does it mean to love. And the passion, before the passion, religions did not discuss love. It was not something that was discussed as part of religion's values. And so that's the place where the West has really really contributed something, and the East, it's all about self-realization, and they're giving us the tools to approach that.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, next up, can we get a reader?
God, can you read that for us, please? Scott?
Let's see if he should be there.
There we go.
There we go.
Make sure my sound is up enough here. In the Yoga Sutras, there are embodied for us the laws of that becoming and the rules, methods, and means which, when followed, make a man, quote, perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect, unquote. Step by step, there is unfolded for us a graded system of development, leading a man from the stage of average good man through those of aspirant, initiate, and master onto the exalted point in evolution at which the Christ now stands. John, the beloved disciple, has said that, quote, we all shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is, unquote. And the revelation of the soul to man in physical plane, incarnation, works ever the great transformation. Christ himself has said that, quote, greater works than I do shall ye do, unquote, holding out to us the promise of the kingdom, the power, and the glory, provided our aspiration and endurance suffice to carry us along the thorny way of the cross and enable us to tread that path which leads uphill all the way to the summit of the Mount of Transfiguration.
Thank you, Scott. Okay, first, in the Yoga Sutras, there are embodied for us the laws of that becoming and the rules, methods, and means which, when followed, make a man, quote unquote, perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. So you know, this is the, she's been comparing and contrasting and showing the how one book follows on the other, right? Starting with the Bhagavad Gita, then going to the New Testament, and now giving us the methodology of the Yoga Sutras. So we here learn that sutras are not so much a book of philosophy, but more a step-by-step manual for spiritual evolution. The laws of becoming are those laws detailed in the sutras that govern a personality's evolution towards its true self, the soul. The rules, methods, and means provide a graded system of development that make up the science needed to become soul infused. Next, step by step, there is unfolded for us a graded system of development, leading a man from the stage of average good man through those of aspirant, initiate, and master on to that exalted point in evolution at which the Christ now stands. So the sutras start with the quote-unquote average good man, which represents the foundation on which soul connection is built. Before one can become an aspirant, one must first establish a basis of right conduct. Later, we'll learn that the commandments, or yama, and rules called niyama, which includes harmlessness, truth, and purity, have to be established in one's daily life before any further yoga practices can be undertaken. Next, John, the beloved disciple, has said that, quote, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And the revelation of the soul to man in physical plane incarnation works ever the great transformation. Again, later in the text, the mind is described as mind stuff, or citta, which takes on the nature and color of whatever it reflects or meditates on. So by contemplating the Christ principle, him as he is, the mind of the aspirant gradually begins to vibrate in unison with that reality. Kindly, Christ himself has said that greater works than I do shall ye do, holding out to us the promise of the kingdom of the power and the glory, provided our aspiration and endurance suffice to carry us along the thorny way of the cross and enable us to tread that path which leads uphill all the way to the summit of the Mount of Transfiguration. So key here is the phrase greater works, which is a confirmation of human evolution through the coming root races, globes, and chains. The quote, kingdom of the power and glory is the fifth kingdom in nature, that of the soul and the hierarchy. The phrase along the thorny way of the cross references the test and trials of the fixed cross. The phrase which leads up the hill all the way to the summit and the Mount of Transfiguration represents the path to the third initiation. This mount is very much like the heights in Capricorn, the mountain of initiation. Okay, any thoughts, any questions about this? All right, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Joe, can you read that for us, please? Joe?
I finally got it to pop open. Thank you. How is this great change brought about? How does man, the victim of his desires and lower nature, become man the victor? Triumph over the world, the flesh, and the devil. It is brought about when the physical brain of the incarnated man becomes aware of the self, the soul, and this conscious awareness only becomes possible when the true self can reflect itself in the mind stuff. The soul is inherently freed from objects and stands ever in the state of isolated unity. Man, however, in incarnation has to arrive in his physical brain consciousness at a realization of these two states of being. He has consciously to free himself from all objects of desire and stand as a unified whole, detached and liberated from all veils, from all forms in the three worlds. When the state of conscious being, as known by the spiritual man, becomes also the condition of awareness of the man in physical incarnation, then the goal has been reached.
Thank you, Joe. First, how is this great change brought about? How does man, the victim of his desires and lower nature, become man the victor, triumph over the world, the flesh, and the devil? It is brought about when the physical brain of the incarnated man becomes aware of the self, the soul, and this conscious awareness only becomes possible when the true self can, quote unquote, reflect itself in the mind stuff. So the transition from victim, one who is controlled by the realm of objective forms, physical appetites, lower mind, and the pride of separateness, to victor, one who has triumphed over these conditions, does not come about by being saved by some external deity, as believed by mainstream Christianity, but rather by conquering illusion by means of the science of the soul, to implement this science, the quote, physical brain of the incarnated man must be stilled so that it can become aware of the soul. It is this brain awareness that marks the true victory over the great illusion. Next, the soul is inherently freed from objects and stands ever in the state of isolated unity. A peculiar term, isolated unity. In the light of the soul, it is described as the ability to completely identify with the true self, the final goal of Raja Yoga. In Rays and Initiations, written 2 decades after this book was written, the term isolated unity is used to describe the first ray method of the technique of fusion. In this context, DK describes isolated unity as a state of consciousness which sees the whole as one, and in which the initiate, not theoretically, but as a realized fact, is identified with that whole. By the way, it is the whole which is isolated in the consciousness of the initiate, not the initiate who regards him or herself as isolated. But we still might ask, why the term isolated unity? Perhaps it is because identification of the initiate is with a whole that is progressively expanding. Consequently, while they have achieved unity with a specific sphere, they have not yet realized oneness with a greater, more encompassing whole. For example, a sixth initiate identifies with the realm ruled by his or her planetary logos, but not yet with the entire solar system. Thus, his or her consciousness of unity is an isolated segment within that greater whole. Yes, Tia.
It's really interesting because we're talking about the continuity of consciousness, and you've been going back between Blavatsky and Alice Bailey. And I think it's interesting because the third installment of the writings is supposed to be the revelation. And so what we've been doing here, and you know, again, what you've pointed out is that Blavatsky gives us the construct. She gives us the but in a way that's monumental, because she helps us find the underlying spiritual truth in all religions that they have been trying to teach. And then we have Master DK through Alice Bailey that gives us the road of the disciple. How do you free yourself from that traditional man at the mercy of externals to man, the conqueror in charge of his own life? And where do we go with that? Well, we have to move into group consciousness, but group consciousness not based on a limited understanding of community, which is what most people have, which is very much just heart-centered, but not within a mental detachment and precision, which is going to be necessary for the group work. It is going to be based on isolated unity. Mankind who is in touch or very conscious of his role within the cosmic whole and able to utilize that within a group environment, but still maintaining isolated unity and responsibility in the same way that hierarchy works. Right. And not from, you know, and from just borrowing a little bit from astrology, moving upon the cardinal cross, which is the cross really of initiation and invention. And that's what will be required of us, not innovation, what we're working with now of what is already there, or just commitment and pursuing what is already manifested. In that great time, we will be bringing in the new and working from the point of the hierarchy or the cardinal cross.
Yeah, well said. You know, you bring up a point that I'd like to expand on, which is One's group, which ultimately is one's ashram, is an isolated unity, right? It's that with which one is able to fully identify, right? And it's progressively enlarges. You know, a high initiate would be able to truly be group conscious and thus able to identify with his ashram. And this would be the first of a progressive series. Well, not necessarily the first, but early in a progressive series of isolated unities that initiate will be experiencing. Thank you, Tia. Okay. Are there ideas, thoughts, questions? Next. However, man in incarnation has to arrive in his physical brain consciousness at a realization of these two states of being. He has consciously to free himself from all objects of desire and stand as a unified whole, detached and liberated from all veils, from all forms in the three worlds. Okay, so the two states are freedom from physical and emotional attachment, which then allows the initiate to achieve that inclusive state of consciousness called isolated unity. The challenge is that whereas the soul is eternally in these states, the quote-unquote man and incarnation is not. The task is to transfer these two spiritual conditions into physical brain consciousness so that they become the factual reality of the disciple's physical plane life. This is what's necessary to truly prepare for the initiations that are involved. In this case, it would be the second. And finally, when the state of consciousness being known by the spiritual man becomes also the condition of awareness of the man in physical incarnation, then the goal has been reached. This is the goal of the spiritual path as described in the Yoga Sutras. It's not achieved by escaping the body to find the soul on some higher plane, but by bringing the full consciousness of the soul down into the lower quaternary, even into the physical brain. Okay? Okay, next step, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Let's see, who would like to read now? Barbara, can you read for us, please?
Yes. The man is no longer what his physical body makes him. When identified with it, the victim of the world. He walks free with shining face, and the light of his countenance is shed abroad upon all he meets. No longer do his desires swing the flesh into activity, and no longer does his astral body subjugate him and overcome him. Through dispassion and the balancing of the pairs of opposites, he has freed himself from the moods, feelings, longings, desires, and emotional reactions which characterize the life of the average man, and has arrived at a point of peace. The devil of pride, the personification of the misused mental nature, and the distorted perception of the mind are overcome, and he stands liberated from the three worlds. The nature of the soul, the qualities and the activities inherent in the love nature of the Son of God, and the wisdom which demonstrates when love and activity, the second and third aspects, are brought together, characterize his life on earth. And he can say, as did the Christ, it is finished.
Thank you, Barbara. First, the man is no longer what his physical body makes him when identified with it. the victim of the world. He walks free with shining face, 1 Corinthians verse 3. And the light of his countenance is shed abroad upon all he meets. No longer do his desires swing the flesh into activity, and no longer does his astral body subjugate him and overcome him. So by shifting the center of consciousness to the soul, a disciple breaks the link of identification with the personality, which includes the turmoils of personality life. He uses the body, but is no longer identified with it. The cited verse, 1 Corinthians 3, is actually a full chapter where St. Paul addresses the infancy of the soul and the building of the spiritual foundation, often referred to by theosophists because it provides the biblical terminology for the quote-unquote temple of God and the wise master builder. The quote, he walks free with shining face and the light of his countenance is shed abroad upon all he meets, is actually paraphrases many different verses. Without getting in too nerdy on all this, he walks free refers to 2 Corinthians 3:17. Now the Lord is that spirit, and where the spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty, hence the walking free. In esoteric terms, this is the liberation from the three worlds of human endeavor. With shining face refers to 2 Corinthians 3:18, but we all with unveiling face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image. It also echoes Exodus 34:29, where Moses' face shone after being in the presence of God. The light of his countenance is shed abroad is a blend of the Lord makes his face shine upon thee, from Numbers 6:25, and Lord, lift thou up the light of thy countenance upon us, from Psalm 4:6. So yeah, sorry about that. I sometimes get kind of nerdy around these things and really want to dive into the weeds, but I held back some. Any thoughts or questions about anything? I'm looking at the chat.
Yes. Ariane has a couple of things here. She says, Jnana Yoga or Advaita Vedanta's aim is to move beyond duality, even beyond the witness, to union with all that is. And right. Then she goes on to say, the sattvic individual understands all acts as opportunities and as service. There is no longer personal aims nor desires.
Right. Thank you, Ariane. Yeah. Well said. Okay. How are we doing here? We're right towards the end. Let me get through this passage, though. Next. Through dispassion and the balancing of the pairs of opposites, he has freed himself from the moods, feelings, longings, desires, and emotional reactions which characterize the life of the average man, and has arrived at the point of peace. The devil of pride, the personification of the misused mental nature, and the disordered perceptions of the mind are overcome, and he stands liberated from the three worlds. So true dispassion comes through achieving a balanced perspective that sees the point of origin of each of the pairs of opposites. The yogi feels neither desire nor aversion, and thus stands at the point of peace. It's like the upper point of the triangle, which is the true symbol of Libra and the triumph of Libra, before one's initiation into a higher cycle through Aries. And then finally, we have the nature of the soul the qualities and activities inherent in the love nature of the Son of God, and the wisdom which demonstrates when love and activity, the second and third aspects, are brought together, characterize his life on earth. And he can say, as did Christ, it is finished. So wisdom, an aspect of the second ray, is activated through the fusion of love and active intelligence. It's a very important idea. You need the second ray to bring active intelligence or knowledge and elevate it to wisdom. When a disciple walks the earth in this state, they are no longer a personality struggling towards goodness, because the qualities of the soul now naturally characterize their daily physical existence, even when met with the greatest of difficulties. Esoterically, this liberated state of consciousness, as well as the declaration, it is finished, are associated with the fourth initiation. Yes, Tia.
As a final thought, I just wanted to add, because you mentioned so much about Libra and the balancing of the opposites. I think that, you know, at the higher, as the highly evolved Libra that has integrated its Aries point, you're able to strategize and able to, and I think that's well reflected in someone like Mahatma Gandhi, who went beyond just the law and the polar opposites, but was able to see, you know, the true goal and bring it to completion. But what I'd like to add is also the balancing comes in Sagittarius as well. And I think that's really important, because now we're in the seventh or eighth age where there's so much form. Remember that Gemini is gathering a lot of data. It is able to work in that commerce of information. But it's the Sagittarian that's able to see and synthesize that information into a cohesive whole and communicate it, which is what makes Sagittarians great teachers, along with Geminis and Leos, into a cohesive whole that is understandable and will take you from the mutable cross into, you know, the Leo, and then finally the Aries, which is the inventiveness. So we need both to work with both of those energies.
Yeah, that's an apt comparison. I like that. The nature of the Libran and Sagittarian, but the Sagittarian is drawing on its polar opposite in Gemini for the duality to synthesize, right? Yeah, where it's all within the Libran constitution, depending on where they are in their path of return. Yeah, thanks for that. Well, that's all we can do today, folks. We'll start next time here with this passage. And I really appreciate your attendance. I hope you enjoyed the presentation, and we'll meet. Well, Biel, you want to give us dates?
Sure. First thing coming up is The Secret Doctrine on the 15th of February, so that's next week at 8 p.m. Then TCF on the 27th of February at 8 p.m. And then we'll meet again for Light of the Soul 1 March at 8 p.m.
Okay, I think isn't there a TCF this coming Friday as well?
What's the this coming second? Friday?
Friday.
No, I don't think there is.
Let's see, what,
let me look at the calendar.
The second and fourth Fridays, because the Friday
they usually don't reschedule that if they're. You had one on the 13th. It's the second and fourth, so that was the 13th, and then the 27th.
You're right. You're right. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the 13th.
That's correct. Yeah. Okay, good, good.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, sorry. We're not that far into the month, are we?
It's this Friday, the 13th.
It is this coming Friday, the 13th. Yes, thank y'all.
Right. Best place possible to spend a Friday the 13th is on a TCF webinar. And then the Sunday, 2 days after that, will be the sacred doctrine.
And of course, the most important one in the middle, Valentine's Day.
Right on Sat. That's right. So it's a jam-packed end of week. And now I'm getting a million hearts. Thank you all. Much love to you all. And okay, well then, the next event is next Friday.
It's coming Friday.
Venus on Cosmic Fire. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Good, good. All right.
Thank you, everybody.
See you next time.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.